Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Illusion versus Reality in America. We return to part two of The Matrix, A Further Exploration. I hope you'll stay tuned. The Matrix was a bad but famous movie of 1999. Dystopian science fiction. Escaping the Matrix was a good but little-known essay of 1999. The movie did have a good point. Most people go through their day with an entirely false picture in their heads about how the world actually works. In the movie, this manufactured false image is known as the Matrix. People think they are free citizens enjoying freedom of action. In reality, they are mere crops awaiting harvest to nurture their alien masters. The writer of the good essay, Richard K. Moore, sees the film as a great metaphor for how the world actually operates under our current regime of neoliberal economic theory, corporate capitalism, and a political system rigged so that the plunder of the 99% by the 1% never ceases. I think it's a fine essay, but it covers so much ground it is forced to stay fairly general. But now we have a tapestry that weaves together the essay and also many particular examples of what Richard K. Moore is saying. Moore's essay is read by Lynn Gurry. That reading, and all the other audio here, is drawn from the 20-year history of the weekly radio program Unwelcome Guests. The weaving was done by the program's current producer, Robin Upton. I think it makes excellent radio. I'm calling our serialization of this audio tapestry The Matrix, A Further Exploration. Today we have part two. As we pick up, the show discusses how the post-war elites kept the American working class and middle class docile by keeping them prosperous. But as Europe's and Japan's industries recovered from the war, corporate profits began to level off. To increase their profits, the elite sacrificed the public prosperity. If you're old enough and working class, you may remember feeling more prosperous in the 1970s than you do today. That's not an accident, and it's not your own fault. On with the show.
Besides failing to deliver popular passivity, the policy of prosperity for Western populations had another downside, having to do with Japan's economic success. Under the Pax Americana umbrella, Japan had been able to industrialize and become an imperial player. The prohibition on Japanese rearmament had become irrelevant. With Japan's then lower living standards, Japanese producers could undercut prevailing prices and steal market share from Western producers.
749.
And then this lovely 30-year period, 1945 to 75, came to an end. The Europeans had the bad taste to rebuild their economies. The Japanese, equally, the bad taste to rebuild their economies. And, of course, being capitalist economies, they knew who they had to beat. They had to beat the United States. They had to produce what the United States produced, either better quality or a cheaper price, or best of all, both. Otherwise, they'd have no chance. In a world dominated by the United States, militarily, politically, culturally, if you're going to succeed as a capitalist in Japan or Germany or anywhere else, you better outdo the Americans. So they set themselves to do that, and by and large, they did. So by the 1970s, Americans were trading in their Fords and Chevys and buying VWs and eventually Hondas, and you know the rest. The United States could no longer get away with the game for those first 30 years. It had to change the game. And the 1970s was the time when the game got changed. And the basic change of the game was no more wage increases. We're going to compete with these foreigners, and we're going to do it by taking it out on you, the American working class.
623.
Profits were, had not decreased, but certainly flattened out in the late 1970s. And corporations definitely wanted a state regime, a policy regime more amenable to them. And as neoliberalism came in the early 1980s, you see corporate profits indeed increasing excruciatingly quickly. Yes, corporations had a lower rate of profit. It doesn't give them the right to then completely change the society, especially a society that was for a while giving decent incomes to poor people just because they, weren't making so much profit.
Richard Peet is professor of geography at Clark University, and his books include Unholy Trinity, the IMF, World Bank, and WTO, and Geography of Power, the Making of Global Economic Policy.
Western capital needed to find a way to become more competitive on world markets, and Western prosperity was standing in the way. Elite strategists, as Huntington showed, were fully capable of understanding these considerations, and the requirements of corporate growth created a strong motivation to make the needed adjustments in both reality and rhetoric. If popular prosperity could be sacrificed, there were many obvious ways Western capital could be made more competitive. Production could be moved overseas to low-wage areas, allowing domestic unemployment to rise. Unions could be attacked and wages forced down, and people could be pushed into temporary and part-time jobs without benefits. Regulations governing corporate behavior could be removed. Corporate and capital gains taxes could be reduced, and the revenue losses could be taken out of public service budgets. Public infrastructures could be privatized, the services reduced to cut costs, and then they could be milked for easy profits when they deteriorated from neglect. These are the very policies and programs launched during the Reagan-Thatcher years in the U.S. and Britain. They represent a systematic project of increasing corporate growth at the expense of popular prosperity and welfare. Such a real agenda would have been unpopular, and a corresponding matrix reality was fabricated for public consumption. The matrix reality used terms like deregulation, reduced taxes, and privatization, but around them was woven an economic mythology.
629.
For some economists who were involved in this story, there is a further question. Were their theories used to disguise political policies that would otherwise have been very difficult to implement in Britain?
The nightmare I sometimes have about this whole experience runs as follows. I was involved in making a number of proposals which were partly, at least, adopted by the government and put in play by the government. Now, my worry is as follows, that there may have been people making the actual policy decisions, or people behind them, who never believed for a moment that this was the correct way to bring down inflation. They did, however, see that it would be a very, very good way to raise unemployment. And raising unemployment was an extremely desirable way of reducing the strength of the working classes, if you like, that what was engineered there, in Marxist terms, was a crisis of capitalism which recreated reserve army of labour and has allowed the capitalists to make high profits ever since. Now, again, I don't say I believe that story, but when I really worry about all this, I worry whether, indeed, that was really what was going on.
595.
The first was rapid and radical changes imposed from the top by neoliberal politicians and bureaucrats, justified by a real or manufactured crisis. Controls over financial transactions were abolished, publicly owned corporations privatized, trade unions were weakened or destroyed by labour market deregulation, wages and welfare cut. The second phase was one of consolidation, led by massive tax cuts, limiting future government initiatives, and leading to further cuts in public services and the power of government. Over a period of time, people's expectations of their governments were expected to diminish as they adjusted to the new reality. It had been anticipated by New Zealand's New Right revolutionaries that by the early 2000s, our values would have changed and we would have come to think like them, accepting poverty and extreme wealth as both normal and necessary, to pursue personal advantage and to care less about our neighbours. But studies show that in fact our values haven't changed much from those of our parents and grandparents. What is happening, though, is that we are forgetting how things used to be and who changed them. Even as the human and environmental costs of the neoliberal experiment increase, we are finding it harder and harder to imagine how things could be better.
Such a real agenda would have been unpopular, and a corresponding matrix reality was fabricated for public consumption. The matrix reality used terms like deregulation, reduced taxes, and privatization, but around them was woven an economic mythology. The old, failed, laissez-faire doctrine of the 1800s was reintroduced with the help of Milton Friedman's Chicago School of Economics, and less government became the proud modern theme in America and Britain.
The view that they were proposing was really that markets do know best, and that markets are places where private agents pursue private welfare, private benefit, private profit, with all the incentives that go with that. They saw markets as being enormously creative, enormously powerful allocative devices, but also better at making social judgments, better at shaping society than human agencies. And there was a real unwillingness to go back and revisit the origins of the welfare state in New Zealand, to think about why New Zealanders had come to do things the way they did. And because of the lack of historical understanding and the lack of historical depth in the work and thinking of these economists, their work really did come very directly from a single theoretical preconceived position.
The idea that markets know best coincided with right-wing economic theories popular in American universities at the time and practiced by the conservative Reagan and Thatcher administrations. It also fitted well with right-wing attitudes about increasing individual freedom and reducing elected authority. Altogether, these ideas became known as the ideology of the New Right.
And less government became the proud modern theme in America and Britain. Sensible regulations had restored financial stability after the Great Depression and had broken up anti-competitive monopolies such as the Rockefeller Trust and AT&T. But in the new matrix reality, all regulations were considered bureaucratic interference. Reagan and Thatcher preached the virtues of individualism and promised to, quote, get government off people's backs, unquote. The implication was that everyday individuals were to get more money and freedom, but in reality the primary benefits would go to corporations and wealthy investors. The academic term for laissez-faire economics is economic liberalism, and hence the Reagan-Thatcher revolution has come to be known as the neoliberal revolution. It brought a radical change in actual reality by returning to the economic philosophy that led to sweatshops, corruption, and robber baron monopolies in the 19th century. It brought an equally radical change in matrix reality, a complete reversal in the attitude that was projected regarding government. Government policies had always been criticized in the media, but the institution of government had always been respected, reflecting the traditional bond between capitalism and nationalism. With Reagan, we had a sitting president telling us that government itself was a bad thing. Many of us may have agreed with him, but such a sentiment had never before found official favor. Soon, British and American populations were beginning to applaud the destruction of the very democratic institutions that provided their only hope of participation in the political process.
That removed our national bargaining structures that were in place at the time. Most workers in the workforce were covered by a document that was negotiated nationally between unions and employers and set down the basic minimums that they were entitled to at work. And that included things, basic things that you would call human rights, I guess, like lunch breaks, tea breaks, health and safety procedures, personal grievance procedures, wage rates, all those sorts of things that workers are generally come to accept as entitlements when they took a job. And it put workers on their own and gave the employer ultimate power to set those wages and conditions.
Soon, British and American populations were beginning to applaud the destruction of the very democratic institutions that provided their only hope of participation in the political process. I'm reading from an article, Escaping the Matrix, by Richard K. Moore, first published in June of 2000. Continuing. Globalization and World Government. The essential bond between capitalism and nationalism was broken in 1945, but it took some time for elite planners to recognize this new condition and to begin bringing the world system into alignment with it. The strong Western nation-state had been the bulwark of capitalism for centuries, and initial post-war policies were based on the assumption that this would continue indefinitely. The Bretton Woods financial system, the IMF, World Bank, and a system of fixed exchange rates among major currencies was set up to stabilize national economies, and popular prosperity was encouraged to provide political stability. Neoliberalism in the U.S. and Britain represented the first serious break with this policy framework, and brought the first visible signs of the fission of the nation-capital bond. The neoliberal project was economically profitable in the U.S. and Britain, and the public accepted the matrix economic mythology. Meanwhile, the integrated global economy gave rise to a new generation of transnational corporations, and corporate leaders began to realize that corporate growth was not dependent on a strong core nation state.
656.
The arms race is breaking the economies of both of the superpowers. The multinational defense corporations have no great loyalty to the United States. They are no longer U.S. corporations. They make enormous profits and invest the money overseas. They are quite willing to sell the U.S. economy down the drain in order to make their profits.
Indeed, Western nations, with their environmental laws, consumer protection measures, and other forms of regulatory interference, were a burden on corporate growth. Having been successfully field-tested in the two oldest quote-unquote democracies, the neoliberal project moved onto the global stage. The Bretton Woods system of fixed rates of currency exchange was weakened, and the international financial system became destabilizing instead of stabilizing for national economies. The radical free trade project was launched, leading eventually to the World Trade Organization. The fission that had begun in 1945 was finally manifesting as an explosive change in the world system. The objective of neoliberal free trade treaties is to remove all political controls over domestic and international trade and commerce. Corporations have free rein to maximize profits, heedless of environmental consequences and safety risks. Instead of governments regulating corporations, the WTO now sets rules for governments, telling them what kind of beef they must import, whether or not they can ban asbestos, and what additives they must permit in petroleum products. So far, in every case where the WTO has been asked to review a health, safety, or environmental regulation, the regulation has been overturned. Most of the world has been turned into a periphery. The imperial core has boiled down to the capitalist elite themselves, represented by their bureaucratic, unrepresentative WTO world government. The burden of accelerated imperialism falls hardest outside the West, where loans are used as a lever by the IMF to compel debtor nations such as Rwanda and South Korea to accept suicidal, quote, reform packages. In the 1800s, genocide was employed to clear North America and Australia of their native populations, creating room for growth. Today, A similar program of genocide has apparently been unleashed against sub-Saharan Africa. The IMF destroys the economies. The CIA trains militias and stirs up tribal conflicts. And the West sells weapons to all sides. Famine and genocidal civil wars are the predictable and inevitable result. Meanwhile, AIDS runs rampant while the WTO and the U.S. government use trade laws to prevent medicines from reaching the victims. As in the past, Western military force will be required to control the non-Western periphery and make adjustments to local political arrangements when considered necessary by elite planners. The Pentagon continues to provide the primary policing power, with NATO playing an ever-increasing role. Resentment against the West and against neoliberalism is growing in the Third World, and the frequency of military interventions is bound to increase. All of this needs to be made acceptable to Western minds, adding a new dimension to the Matrix. In the latest Matrix reality, the West is called the international community, whose goal is to serve humanitarian causes. Bill Clinton made it explicit with his Clinton Doctrine, in which, as quoted in the Washington Post, he solemnly promised, quote, "If somebody comes after innocent civilians and tries to kill them en masse because of their race, their ethnic background, or their religion, and it is within our power to stop it, we will stop it," close quote. This matrix fabrication is very effective indeed. Who opposes prevention of genocide? Only outside the matrix does one see that genocide is caused by the West in the first place, and that the worst cases of genocide are continuing, that assistance usually makes things worse, as in the Balkans, and that Clinton's handy doctrine enables him to intervene when and where he chooses, since dictators and the stirring of ethnic rivalries are standard tools in managing the periphery. A U.S. president can always find, quote, innocent civilians, wherever elite plans call for an intervention.
A useful summary from episode 304.
The first way that the target regime comes to the attention of the United States, the first way that we begin to look at this country and think of it as a problem, is as a result of complaints from American businesses. It's when nationalist regimes begin to challenge the right of foreign companies to operate as they wish that they first get into trouble with the United States. That's step one. The next step is when the officials of these companies go to their friends in Washington and explain what the problem is. And they say, government of country X is forcing us to obey environmental laws, they're forcing us to pay minimum wage, they're forcing us to pay export taxes, whatever the problem is, they complain bitterly about this, and they ask for redress. Now, the leaders of the U.S. government do not intervene abroad directly to protect or reestablish the interests of corporations. What they do is they take these complaints and they rephrase them and reshape them so that the threat posed by that foreign country is seen not as economic but as geostrategic and political. The argument is that if a country is not going to allow an American company to operate as it wishes, that country must be cruel, repressive, dictatorial, unfair, anti-American, and probably a tool of some very big power that is working assiduously to undermine American interests. Therefore, it is in our strategic and political interests to intervene there and overthrow the government. That's part two. But there's a third way that the motivation morphs. And that is when it becomes time for American leaders to explain to the public why we are carrying out this operation. That's when a third argument takes over. It's the argument that is beautifully calculated to appeal to the very innocent and compassionate souls of most Americans. The argument is, we are not going there to take anything. We are not going there to harm anyone. We are only going there to help. We Americans have developed a society that is so successful. We have freedom. We have prosperity. Not only do we have the right, but maybe Providence has even given us the responsibility, the duty to go to other countries and share our goodness, our benefits with those poor countries, those poor people who don't even realize how much they want to be governed on systems like ours. They don't even know how good it is to be in a free democracy like ours. So we're going to go over there and we're going to give them that democracy, even if they don't realize how much they want it. Americans really are, I think, a very compassionate people. And when you combine that with our general ignorance of the world, you can see how successful this argument is. It appeals to something that's very deep in the American spirit.
In Matrix reality, globalization is not a project, but rather the inevitable result of beneficial market forces. Genocide in Africa is no fault of the West, but is due to ancient tribal rivalries. Every measure demanded by globalization is referred to as reform. The word is never used with irony. Democracy and reform are frequently used together, always leaving the subtle impression that one has something to do with the other. The illusion is presented that all economic boats are rising, and if yours isn't, it must be your own fault. You aren't competitive enough. Economic failures are explained away as temporary adjustments, or else the victim, as in South Korea or Russia, is blamed for not being sufficiently neoliberal. Investor confidence is referred to with the same awe and reverence that earlier societies might have expressed towards the will of the gods. The Western quality of life continues to decline, while the WTO establishes legal precedents ensuring that its authority will not be challenged when its decisions become more draconian. Things will get much worse in the West. This was anticipated in elite circles when the neoliberal project was still on the drawing board, as is illustrated in Samuel Huntington's The Crisis of Democracy report discussed earlier.
Yes, indeed. Here we must pause part two of The Matrix, A Further Exploration. The audio was nicely woven together by Robin Upton of unwelcomeguests.net. Speaking of URLs, our own is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. I am the weaver togetherer of New World Notes, and I thank you for listening to it. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising the following 3 points. 1. Illegitimate non carborundum. 2. Yes, I am aware that that is the worst Latin you've ever heard, and carborundum is not a verb. But 3, I hope you will tune in again anyway next week. Hail and farewell.